Hello and welcome back to the Pisky Trap, a series where we explore the folklore, history, and legends from across Devon and Cornwall. Lovely to be back again. Hope you've all been having a great week. Once again, a big thank you to everyone who's been listening and supporting the series, to all the lovely patrons as well. I really appreciate that, and it really does help. Also, a big thank you to all of you who've been in touch in response to the last Pisky Bite episode where we looked at ill wishing. I'll be doing a little case update episode following on from that, so keep an eye out for that one as well. If you've been listening and you're enjoying this series so far, please give us a like, subscribe. If you're able to share it around with your friends, anyone you know who might be interested in folklore and history, all of that really helps to keep spreading the word and grow this little project. If you can, and you feel like supporting the project further, then please consider checking out my Patreon page at patreon.com/thepiskytrap. This podcast is completely self-funded, so donations there just help me to cover the running costs, source research material, and basically keep the series running, essentially. Right, that's enough of that. Some exciting news. It's looking like I'll be running a talk at the Royal Cornwall Museum, exploring some of the history of witchcraft and cunning folk in Cornwall. So if that sounds like it might be your cup of tea, then keep an eye out on the Instagram and Facebook pages. I'll also do a reminder on the next episode once all the booking stuff is live, and I'll send the links out for where you can book as well. That will be on the 15th of May at the Royal Cornwall Museum in Truro. Okay then, that's all the business bits done. Let's crack on with the episode. For those of you who've been listening for a little while now, you might recall an episode where I collaborated with the Cornish bird, Elizabeth Dale, to talk about the phenomenon of ghost layers. And in that episode, there was one particular story that we explored which, for some reason, it really stuck with me. That was the tale of Tucker's ghost from over at Wendron, which is near Helston. For those of you perhaps not familiar with the story, Robert Hunt, in his popular Romances of the West of England, writes, "On the bleak road between Helston and Wendron church town, at its highest and wildest spot, three roads meet about a quarter of a mile from the latter place. Here, at Three Cross, as the place is called, years ago, when the downs being unenclosed, it was more desolate than it is even now, a poor suicide named Tucker was buried. Few liked to pass up Rose Lane leading there after nightfall, for Tucker's shade had more than once been seen." Now, I won't go into the full story here, but if you want to look into that further, then I recommend checking out the Ghost Layers episode. But there was something about this idea of a place in the landscape, an unhallowed place that people don't want to go to at night, that just attracts folklore to it. That piqued my interest. And for a number of reasons, the crossroads seems to be that place. For centuries, the crossroads at the edge of a community was the place where certain people were buried in unconsecrated ground, and it led to tales of ghosts, spectral hounds, eerie lights and strange noises at night. In parts of Devon, these sites were sometimes known as wished spots, wished being a local term for a ghost or a spirit. In this episode, we're going to be taking a look at some examples from Cornwall and taking a little hop across the Tamar to Devon as well. Looking at a few of these places, the history, as far as we can trace it, and some of the folklore and stories that have become associated with these sites. I should say at the outset that we will be exploring the topic of suicide within historical context and perceptions of the time, as well as talking about types of execution. So there may be a bit of gory detail in there. So if those topics are perhaps not for you, or you're not in the mood for that, then I recommend maybe checking out one of our other Pisky Traps or Little Pisky Bites. But for those of you who are staying with us, without further ado, Here's our next episode, Tales from the Crossroads. I walked alone and thinking, and faint the night wind blew, and stirred on mounds at crossways, the flower of sinner's rue. The opening lines there of a poem by A.E. Housman called Sinner's Rue, that reflects on this idea that there were once sites on the edge of our towns and villages where those who had perhaps taken their own life, or those who had committed certain crimes, were buried in unconsecrated ground. It was usually at a crossroads, an isolated spot at the edge of a parish boundary, or sometimes at the edge of several parish boundaries, variously described by writers as a sort of no man's land, as liminal places or spaces, or a place between places. Sites like this seem to go hand in hand with folk tales and superstition, and those sorts of beliefs seem to have been with us for a very long time. S.I. Johnston's journal Crossroads opens by talking about crossroads in ancient Greece. They write, "Greek and Roman authors describe a variety of rituals and superstitions connected with crossroads. At the time of the new moon, suppers were taken to the images of Hecate found at crossroads. The corpses of those polluted by certain crimes were thrown onto the crossroads and stoned or burned." So Hecate was a Greek goddess associated with magic, witchcraft, the moon, as well as ghosts and crossroads. And it seems that there have been certain rituals and customs associated with crossroads, even going back as far as ancient Greece and Rome. In Britain, there seems to have been a long practice of burying those who had committed certain types of crimes, murder for instance, in specific sites within the landscape and outside of the community. An article in Current Archaeology reads, "Between the 7th and 12th centuries, criminals who were put to death in Anglo-Saxon England were often interred not in community graveyards, but in separate burial grounds. They are often found beside routeways, barrows, or other landmarks, and stand out because of strikingly unusual burials." They're referring to what are known as deviant burials, so they might be face down, for example, or in other unconventional positions, very much as part of a ceremony. And some writers have theorized that this was a kind of, basically, ritual humiliation. They continue to write, "These liminal places were geographically and ideologically ideal for formal executions, and there criminals could be buried, cut off from the rest of the community." Another example of deviant burial is referred to in an article in BBC History magazine by Eugene Byrne, who writes, "Suicide used to be regarded as shocking and blasphemous, and a coroner's verdict of felo de se, literally crime against oneself, usually resulted in the body being buried at a crossroads, with a stake through the heart, and with no religious ceremony. The dead's property could also be confiscated." So, we've established that places such as crossroads were often the sites where criminals were either executed, or after execution may have been displayed in what's known as a gibbet, to serve as a deterrent, and often buried there below the gallows, or nearby in unconsecrated ground. those who had taken their own life, because they were seen to have disrupted the natural order, or perhaps gone against God's will, were similarly interred at the crossroads. I want to take a look directly then at our first example from Cornwall, which takes us back to the medieval period and has a rather unusual outcome. Richard Beville, now don't quote me on the pronunciation of that by the way, who was rector of the parish of Whitstone, which is in northeast Cornwall, in the mid-1300s, is recorded as having died either by his own hand or emulis suis, meaning at the hands of his rivals or enemies. In other words, he may have been murdered. It's thought that he may have been buried at a crossroads. Nicholas Orme, in his book Saints of Cornwall, writes, Richard Beville was instituted as rector of Whitstone in 1350 and died by violence in the early spring of 1359. Local people seem to have disagreed about whether he committed suicide or was killed by his enemies, but his body was given only an inferior burial in the churchyard or in unconsecrated ground. Pilgrims began to visit his grave shortly afterwards, and miracles were ascribed to his assistance. The first recorded one took place in Easter week, 1359, and eventually the body was moved to a tomb inside the church. Pilgrims continued to come to Whitstone for at least the next 2 years, to such an extent that the Bishop of Exeter, John Grandison, took action about the matter in August of 1361. Hearing that people were visiting the place of first burial, so possibly that crossroads or patch of unconsecrated ground, making offerings there, holding vigils on Saturday nights, and bringing food and items for sale, he ordered his official in Cornwall to stop the cult until it had been approved and to inquire into the miracles. Beville, the nearest figure to a Cornish saint after the Norman conquest, belonged to a small group of parish clergy in England who were regarded as saints in the later Middle Ages without being formally canonised. The bishop's investigation subsequently produced a report of 10 miracles, none of them involving gentry or clergy, implying that the cult centred on people of lesser rank. Some of the pilgrims came from Cornwall, including Bodmin. Others had travelled from places in Devon, as far afield as Northam, Plympton, and Winkley. They claimed to have been cured from blindness, crippledness, paralysis, and madness. Grandison's response is not known, but may have been hostile, since no later references to the rector or his cult have been found, and neither has left any tangible remains in Whitstone Church. A really interesting little story that, and a great example of how quickly, in this instance, a cult can develop around a saint at this point in the medieval period. Even a saint not formally canonised, and one that seems to have been adopted and embraced, not by those in the higher ranks of society, but by the ordinary people of the region. Contrary to what you might expect of a burial in unconsecrated ground where the site is maybe shunned or avoided by the community, it sounds like it developed into a bit of a fair, essentially, with people selling things on that site. So, to me, it's not surprising that the bishop was probably thinking, hang on, what's all this about? I should probably check into this. Moving on to another example, quite by accident a few weeks back, I was looking on GeoReference Maps, which, if you don't know it, it's basically a site where you can view older maps, but with the option of having the modern overlay as well, to see how places and the landscape has changed. And as I was kind of hovering over the area around Probus, I found a little place on the map that immediately drew my attention. It was called Wakeham's Grave. A fairly unusual name for a local site, so of course I instantly wanted to find out more about what might lie behind the name. So I did a quick Google search and straight away found an article in the Probus News magazine dated April 2021, which read, "In last month's edition, as part of the walk around Probus, the route went past Wakeham's grave, this being the old crossroads between Tregony Road and the old road that runs just behind the bypass. I made the comment, who was Wakeham?" They go on to write, "I've had several responses about the origin of Wakeham's grave, so thanks to all those who've contacted me. One was from a long-time resident of the village who stated that Wakeham was the last person to be hanged there. Another pointed me to the Book of Probus, where the authors Alan Kent and Danny Merrifield wrote, folk memory suggests Wakeham may have been a highwayman. However, we do know that in the 1700s, 1800s and early 1900s, suicides were often buried at crossroads. We can find no entries in early newspapers, although perhaps we should not expect any, as the family would have been ashamed of the death." End quote. The mention of burials in the 1900s doesn't appear to be correct, by the way, and we'll talk about that in more detail later. I wanted to try and find out more, and I have to say it wasn't very easy, though eventually I did come across a reference to the site in the Western Morning News dated August 20th, 1923. A man named John Johnson from Sticker had written in with the following information. "Near Hyatris Trail, at the Four Crossroads, is Roger Wakeham's grave, on the ancient highway from Grampound to Truro. Local legend has it that Roger was a miner who, for devious practices in defrauding Edward VI, when Duke of Cornwall of Tin Dues, was outlawed by Sir Walter Raleigh, Lord Warden of the Stannaries, in the reign of Queen Elizabeth. Roger became a Knight of the Road," meaning a highwayman, "and levied dues on rich and poor alike. Growing reckless, he raided not only the church and chapel of Probus, but the very sanctuary itself, in which dwelt the Lord Rector and canons. The church, which had hitherto tolerated Roger as a parishioner, thereupon let loose the sheriff on its recalcitrant and sacrilegious member, with the result that Roger was hanged and buried in full sight of the church, chapel and sanctuary which he had violated." End quote. A brilliant bit of local folklore there, weaved into local history. And I'm really glad that I managed to find that article. Of course, how much of it is based on truth is, well, it's difficult to say, and probably tricky to verify, but it's fascinating nonetheless as a story. And perhaps gives us an explanation for how the site got its name. And who knows, maybe it was the resting place of that highwayman, Roger Wakeham. John Johnson's article back in 1923 has provided us with more besides, as he actually opens by referring to another site not that far away, which he calls Long Robin's Grave. He writes, "Sir, some months ago, a correspondent in your columns solicited particulars of Long Robin's Grave, situate at the 8th milestone from St. Moore's on the Tregony Road in the parish of Verian, and I have gathered the following tradition from the residents in the locality. Robin Long commenced his career as a freebooter, corsair, pirate and smuggler during the Commonwealth, and confined his operations to the English Channel and St. Moore's Harbour, bringing his prizes into the Porthcawl River. Shortly after the Restoration in 1660, Robin was detected in some particularly daring enterprise in Verian Bay by the naval authorities, and, as a warning to the pirates who frequented Lamoran Creek, was hanged in chains at the St. Moore's and Rouen Lamoran crossroads, and interred, as was the custom, beneath the gallows." Johnson goes on to highlight how lawless the local area was at the time, pointing out that close by is yet another crossroads site named Bessie Beneath, where a highway woman by the name of Bessie Nan Curvis was said to have been buried. Now, I'm not going to go into the story of Bessie here, as there's a brilliant episode exploring it that was put together by my fellow podcaster and blogger, Elizabeth Dale, aka the Cornish Bird. So I'll pop a link to that episode in the show notes, as I recommend checking that one out. As for Robin Long, so far I haven't been able to find out a huge amount of information to verify the historical accuracy of this account. But if you're a local historian or someone with a good local knowledge who might be able to help further, then please do get in touch, as it'd be great to find out more. I feel I should perhaps elaborate on this punishment described in Long Robin's case there, known as hanging in chains. And this is where it starts to get a little bit gory, by the way. César de Saussure was a Swiss visitor to Britain in the 1720s and 30s, and he wrote an account of his experiences, the way people lived along with certain customs, and he details this practice of so-called gibbeting at a crossroads. He writes, "After hanging, murderers are punished in a particular fashion. They are first hung on the common gibbet. Their bodies are then covered with tallow and fat substances. Over this is placed a tarred shirt, fastened down with iron bands, and the bodies are hung with chains to the gibbet, which is erected on the spot, or as near as possible to the place where the crime was committed, and there it hangs till it fall to dust. This is what is called in this country to be hanged in chains." This sort of punishment does seem to have been a thing with maritime crimes in particular. For instance, in Wapping in East London, pirates and those who had committed certain crimes at sea, such as murder, were hanged at a place known as Execution Dock, and then their bodies might be gibbeted on the riverbank, hanging there as a deterrent to other would-be pirates. We haven't done so for a little while, but I wanted to take a little trip across the Tamar to West Devon, and to a particular site and a story associated with it. There's one rather well-known location, which is known as Jay's Grave up on Dartmoor, said to be the resting place of Kitty Jay or Mary Jay. If you were to look at images of it, it's quite a unique place. The gravesite itself is sort of in the middle of the crossroads there. And there's a lot of folklore attached to it. In fact, there's even a song called Kitty Jay, written by singer-songwriter Seth Lakeman. Now, I decided that I didn't want to delve any deeper into the Kitty Jay story, simply because there's already quite a lot of information out there. A lot of folklorists have talked about it in the past, and I suppose I didn't really feel I had anything new to add. Though, if it is something that you guys are interested in hearing about, then let me know, and maybe we can look at it again at some point in the future. Instead, I want to look at a site and a story from over near Tavistock, and it's one that I feel is often overlooked. And that is a place called Stephen's Grave. It's on the western edge of Dartmoor, not far from the village of Peter Tavy. And the story surrounding it seems to go back to the 18th century. The 1990 version of a book called Crossing's Guide to Dartmoor mentions a George Stephens of Peter Tavy. However, Eric Hemery in High Dartmoor refers to a John Stephens, who died in October 1762. So there's already some confusion about the exact identity of this person. That said, We have a partial account of the tale, written down by a member of a family called the Brays, who are pretty central to this story. And it was passed down through the family in the form of letters kept in an old chest. This was then passed on to Sabine Baring Gould, who we've encountered in the past, who in turn recounted the tale in a publication entitled Transactions of the Devonshire Association back in 1901. So I've managed to find a copy of it, and I've copied it down, and I had to sort of translate a few little elements of it, because it's written in the language of the time, with spelling errors as well. So I'm going to read it through in full. Keep in mind it's in the wording of that time, and it reads as follows. An account of the death of John Stevens, who poisoned himself on account of Mary Bray, whom he had been paying his addresses, in other words, courting or going out with, in October 1762. John Stevens lived with Mr. Roger Chubb at the farm of Godsworthy in the parish of Peter Tavy, a man of appearance and of good character as a farmer's servant. He had formed some intimacy with one Mary Bray, which did not meet much opposition on her part. The said Mary Bray was the daughter of Andrew and Mary Bray, who were farmers at Wedlake in the parish of Peter Tavy. And when they were brought acquainted with the said courtship, they became altogether against it, which they and their son worked such influence with the daughter as to very nearly break off all intercourse between them, which proved fatal to the said John Stevens. So, basically, Mary's family put a stop to her seeing John. The account continues. It appeared to have taken such great impression on him, so much that he was heard to say, about a week before it took place, that he should be down in Peter Tavy churchyard before that day week, and seemed quite low in spirits as well as in manners. In the same week, it happened to have been Michaelmas Fair at Tavistock, which in the days it was much kept up by the country people. At which the said John Stevens was there, and Mary Bray was there, and her father and mother also. The said John Stevens endeavoured to have introduced himself into the company of the said Mary Bray, but was not able, as the said Mary Bray was into another company, and was seen walking with another young man, which undoubtedly increased his jealousy, and prompted him to commit so rash an act, which he soon carried into effect. He went to a drugster's shop and purchased some poisons, he told them, to poison rats. It was supposed that he took some of it before he came out of town, as it was proved at the inquest. He went into Mr. Cornday's house, the barber's, and there he was taken very unwell, urging and vomiting. But it passed. Away after some time, he then left the house, and by some means got in the company of the said Mr. and Mrs. and Mary Bray, and came home with them as far as Redge, where they all went in together. And it was thought that he intended there to have poisoned himself and the said Mary Bray, but he had not the opportunity of doing it. They left there all together, and went on together as far as Yellon Corner, where they parted companies. Mr. and Mrs. and Mary Bray for Wedlake, which was about 3 parts of a mile further on, John Stevens for Godsworthy, where he arrived about 10 o'clock at night. Soon after he came home, he was taken very ill, urging and vomiting at a furious sight, which throwed all the people of the house in a great confusion. Mr. Chubb wished him to give consent to fetch the doctor, but he would not give consent for some time, but still getting worse, Mr. Chubb rode after the doctor. But before the doctor came, he was dead. As soon as he had seen the body, he perceived that it had been poisoned, as it bared every mark of its swelling and discolouring very much, insomuch that they were forced to carry him out of the house the next morning. The smell was so bad, they carried him up in a corner of a field, and put him in a hole that was made for a sheep to pass from one field to another, and was called, that bit of text is missing, unfortunately, something corner, where he remained before he was buried. An inquest was held on the body, and the jury returned a verdict that the body should be buried at the first four crossways, and he was forthwith buried near Broadmoor Corner, on the Peter Tavy Parish Command, where the grave is to be seen at this day. It's quite a tragic story, really. And what's interesting to me, which you don't often get, is the amount of detail. We have this backstory of the relationship with Mary Bray, which is broken off by her parents, the encounter at the fair, and then the specifics of what allegedly happened following the fair, and John taking the poison. Of course, without looking at the original letters, it's hard to say how much has been added, embellished, as the story was passed on to the Devonshire Association. But I find it really intriguing. It doesn't seem to have taken long at all for the story of John Stevens, or perhaps George Stevens, depending on the source you read, to weave its way into local folklore. A short time after his death, the site of Stevens' grave at the crossroads was said to be haunted, and his ghost was reputedly seen at other locations too. The original account goes on to say, "It was reported that the said John Stevens was seen after that he was buried, that he was seen at Godsworthy and at Wedlake, and in the path leading from each farm to the place where he was buried. The people of each farmhouse were frequently alarmed by unusual noises and rattling of the things of the house, before they applied to the Reverend Dr. Jago of Tavistock, and then heard no more. But he appeared to the said Mary Bray after she left her father's house and went into service, insomuch that she received an injury, as a woman pregnant or as one looking for child, and had a wound to the day of her death, that she would not make known how she got it, nor what she had seen, but would not deny but that she had seen something. She was never married, nor never had any sweethearts. She lived till the 3rd of May, 1816. So that's where the tale seems to end. We're told that Mary Bray was 72 years of age when she died in 1816, which would mean that around the time of the events in the story, she would only have been around 18 years old. Again, it's hard to say how much is simply legend and how much is based on truth. But it's interesting that when you look at a map of the local area, the farms of Godsworthy and Wedlake they're pretty much side by side. They're very close to one another. And just to the north of there, in its isolated location, is the site of Stephen's grave. And there would have been tracks going between those two farms and heading east from Peter Tavy across the moor, which would have passed the site. To me, it's not really a surprise that people quickly regarded the area as being haunted. And according to local legend, as the body of Stevens was lowered into the ground, it was said that a white sheet that had been hanging on a nearby washing line was blown up into the sky and flew away, never to be seen again. And this was presumably taken to be some kind of omen. After that, locals claimed that the ghost of Stevens could be seen wandering around the site of his grave on dark nights, and a lot of people wouldn't go near there after dark. Apparently, in the 1930s, the Dartmoor Preservation Society placed the stone, which is at the site, on a more secure plinth. It had obviously become a bit worn and a bit precarious. And there's now a letter S engraved on the pillar too. The practice of crossroads burial seems to have continued through the 18th and into the 19th centuries. I've found references to a crossroads burial on the outskirts of Sidmouth in Devon from around 1811. It's referred to in a separate inquest a few decades later, dated 1862, where they write, we are informed that the last verdict of a similar character was given nearly 50 years ago on the body of a woman named Jenny Pine, who was buried in the crossroad leading to Mutter's Moor, a spot still known as Jenny Pine's Corner. A few years on from the burial of Jenny Pine, there's an article in the Royal Cornwall Gazette dated the 8th of February, 1823, which recounted a coroner's inquest following the death of an apprentice on a farm at Lezant. They write, "The jury returned a verdict of felo de se, and the body was interred near four crossroads." This must have been one of the last examples, because later that same year, 1823, an act was passed, finally allowing those who had taken their own lives to be interred in the churchyard. But it had to be done at night, and still without a Christian service. In fact, it wasn't until 1882 that this was reviewed again and allowed burial to take place in daylight hours. The public execution of criminals was phased out in the 19th century as well, the last recorded one being the hanging of Michael Barrett at Newgate Prison in London in 1868. That same year, the Capital Punishment Within Prisons Act stated, and I quote, "The body of every offender executed shall be buried within the walls of the prison within which judgment of death is executed on him," end quote. So, essentially, as the 19th century went on, the laws changed, and with it perceptions of old customs such as crossroads burial began to change as well. You quickly start to see the subject being talked about in newspapers and journals, with historians and folklorists and certain campaigners for social change who refer to these examples from the past, often in a kind of mocking tone, considering it ancient and barbaric, even though, in some cases, it had only been a decade or two since the practice had been widespread. At the same time, the interest in folklore was developing. People were starting to gather together all the local stories and superstitions and write them down for the first time. The likes of Sabine Baring Gould, for example. Now they were looking back to the crossroads as a source for those local ghost stories, those long-forgotten characters, their foul deeds and escapades, or their tragic stories. We've looked at a few examples there from crossroads in Cornwall and Devon, and no doubt there are probably many stories and sites out there that have yet to be discovered or have been lost over the centuries. I, for one, find these places fascinating because of the tales that are attached to them, and many of them can be quite hard to source. A lot of these places are now overlooked because, well, the roads have changed, the landscape has changed as well. But for me, it's a link back to our past. One that's, well, it's quite dark, and some might argue that maybe should be forgotten. But I think the crossroads serves as a reminder of the way people in the past once viewed the world around them. A time when folk were perhaps more superstitious, retained ancient customs, and perhaps feared what might happen if these rituals weren't carried out. Times and practices have changed, and we've come a long way. But some of the stories stay with us. And going through certain lonely crossroads at night, it can make you pause and reflect for a moment, if you know these stories. Or you may just wish to avoid that particular area at night altogether. That's it for this episode. Some heavy topics in there, for sure. As a researcher, I'm often drawn to these darker tales and aspects of our past, and I hope that you found it interesting as well. If it sparked any particular thoughts or ideas, then please feel free to get in touch. You can email me at thepiskytrap@gmail.com. I'll pop that link to the Cornish Bird episode in the show notes for anyone who's interested, And I'll also be putting out that case update episode very soon as well. The Pisky Trap is written and produced by me, Keith Wallace, with music by Elizabeth Westcott and artwork by Karis Harrington. That's it from me. Thanks for listening.